Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the Driving Eureka podcast, episode number 22. Our theme this week is change, and it's actually one of the quotes I put out on my website, Doug, which is, you change your thinking, you change the results that you see. So on changing your mind, I mean, everything is really about change, isn't it?
Yeah, and then this came, I was in New York recently for the show with community colleges, League for Innovation and Community Colleges. And I went to see the show Kinky Boots, the Broadway musical, and which is a great fun show. Okay. And the big lesson at the last song is, you change the world when you change your mind. And which is sort of a theme we've had the last couple of weeks here. You know, you have that mindset of curiosity, you're going to bump into new ideas. When you have a mindset of experimentation, you're going to bump into stuff. When you mindset of learning, then when something doesn't work, you just say, hey, that's cool, I learned something. And call it discovery, collaboration, responsibility, I don't care what it is, but it's a matter of how you make a choice to, is your mindset going to be one that is, to quote Norman Vincent Peale, positive thinking or negative thinking? And when we think positively, when we think towards the future, we unleash the power of the brain to do just truly amazing things. And when we think negatively, we just become a wimpy, whining, huddled masses, you know? I mean, that's what I'm talking about. It's, how am I going to approach life? How am I going to approach life right now? What is the framing that I'm going to take? Because it's just stuff, but our mind interprets it and either sees opportunity or dread.
So as you work with different organizations, just your feel, what is their thinking? Is there kind of is it on an individual basis? Is it on a cultural basis or both? How do you see it?
I think it is primarily, I think a lot of individuals will blame their culture. And there is some truth to that. But I've worked for the world's biggest corporations. I did 10 years time inside the soap factory, Procter & Gamble. And I maintained my mindset, even in a world of bureaucracy and, you know, blue-bloodedness, if you would. You are not a prisoner to your organization. It's a mindset that you've taken. And I think, you know, throughout organizations, you find people that can get stuff done. You find stuff, people doing amazing things, and you go, well, how do they get it? Well, they've chosen to have that optimistic mindset. They've chosen they're going to work that way. And that's it. That's it. So I think it really is inside the person. I think it's a personal thing mostly. There is some element of the culture makes it easier or harder, but it comes from within. I mean, it comes from within you.
Well, with so many organizations that do have, you know, cultures that are, I don't know, facilitating, where, you know, 2/3 of the people are not engaged in their work. That was from a Gallup poll that was out there, you know, those types of things. I know, and I get what you're saying. If you have your mindset is set anyway, no matter what the culture is, you know, you're going to find a way, but it does have an impact on the masses. Isn't it easier to, well, I'm not going to say it's easier, but.
Yeah, but let's flip the two options.
Okay. Though. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a mindset of optimism and discovery and curiosity, and I'm going to drive new things. And I'm in a culture that doesn't support it. Okay, that's option one. Mm-hmm. Option two, I have a culture that supports this, but I don't have any desire or any curiosity myself. Okay, which one's going to have the bigger chance of success? I'd say the first one. Change comes from within you. We use the culture as excuses for not taking responsibility for our lives. We use it as an excuse. That's my view. Because it's become easy to us. You know, you start out on the job and you're a volcano of new ideas. Then you learn about all of the stuff and you either give up or you figure out a way to make things happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's part of me, and you know my pull on the Deming side, and this is where I'm going to challenge that a bit, which is 94% of the performance of an organization coming from the system, and, you know, 6%, you know, not just the individual, but certainly associated with the individual. So how do you square that? I mean,
I give you that with regards to the overall organization.
Yes.
But I have as Kevin Cahill, his grandson, says, I have a sphere of influence. My life is not determined by the stock price. I work in X department trying to do things, and I can find joy in work in my area by the mindset that I take towards that. In other words, don't boil the ocean. Don't make me responsible for the damn stupid board of directors and the dumb CEO. That's not my problem. But I can take charge of my life right now, because I have a sphere of influence, which is always much bigger than people realize, that you can change your mindset and the way you work right now. And that's why with our fundamentals course that we teach, that you can take online or in person, our whole thing, when we took and flipped Trip from teaching, well, we'll do the culture if you want, but when we took a flip to empowering people, enabling individuals to be able to think quicker, smarter, more creatively, to help them do it, it was just mind-blowing, the impact that you had when you were able to just ignite people and say, stop whining, for Christ's sakes. Let's do something. Let's do something with our lives.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, though, if, you know, some people, for instance, that would take the class, they still run up against the system, and they may get to the point where they just say, the heck with this.
That's right.
I'm going to move on somewhere else.
And that's and that's an option too. Yeah. That's an option too. But that's why we tell them when they're starting to focus on where they're going to apply the stuff, because we coach them through applying it, is we say, let's take something that's in your sphere of influence. What's the things where you can control it? You know, because that's where you do that, and it builds your confidence, it builds your capability, and then you do it again. And then next thing you know, people in the next department over. I mean, we've seen it over and over again. People in the next department are reaching over and go, man, that's kind of fun. How do you guys get to do that cool stuff? Can we do that? Oh, yeah, sure. This is how we did it. Here, you can take this course, read this book, you know, whatever it is. We can do that too.
So this is kind of the process of creating critical mass. I guess I could see that. That's certainly a longer process. But I also see nowadays, with especially the mindset of people today, almost being individual contractors, just saying, I could do this at my company, but, you know, that's just a bureaucracy I don't want to fight. I'm going to start an idea, you know, on my own, and I'll start to build a business off of that. I mean, I know that would be an option.
And I'm agnostic to that. I mean, our mission is to change the world by enabling innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day.
Right.
I'm here to do the people. We're about people. You know, if a CEO wants to get a lot of their peoples, I'm good. But we work for people. We change lives by changing people. When you change the mindset of a person, that's how you make amazing things happen. Corporations don't think. People think. Corporations don't get patents. A person gets a patent and assigns it to the company. Power to the people is what we're about. You know, that's what old hippies like us do. You know?
Speak for yourself. Okay. Well, let's continue this conversation, but let's move to...
Wait. There's one thing I want to say. And so I started out with the Kinky Boots quote, you change the world when you change your mind. And you know, the secret to changing your life truly is, I honestly, truly, in my heart of hearts, believe that it's about changing your mind. It doesn't take money or contacts or resources. It requires taking responsibility for how you're thinking. I mean, if you think about it, You are the leader of what is right. Your boss, your partner, your community are not the leader of you or of what's right for you. And when you have the mindset of the bigger person, you generate energy around you in support of the change that's needed in your world and the broader world. As Hamilton sings in the play by the same name, I just recently saw it, in the song Nonstop, he's talking to Burr at the time. He said, hey, what are you waiting for? What do you stand for? What?
Well, he was, Burr wound up being a guy that, in essence, kind of wasted his life at the end after shooting Hamilton. So he kind of lost his way.
Yeah, kind of lost it.
It's kind of a sad story, actually. Guy goes from being vice president to there. But it's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. Okay, well, let's move to the Driving Eureka book segment. And it's a continuation, basically, of the conversation that we have. And it's this conversation we had, apparently, with Bill Conway. Why don't you share with us about that?
So I was I did an interview with Bill Conway. He's the first Fortune 500 CEO to bring Deming back from Japan to work with him. And he told me that Dr. Deming had told him that it was important to work with the willing. And I challenged Kevin Cahill, Dr. Deming's grandson, leader of the Deming Institute, what advice would you give to an employee who's working for a leader who is unwilling to learn or change? And I'm going to read this quote because I think it's important. And this is an excerpt from the book. There's a wonderful Q&A with Kevin Cahill in the book. It's worth the price of the book just to read it because, you know, so much of Deming is written about in the past of where he was, that he can become a museum figure if we're not careful. And the interview with Kevin brings to life today's world and things like this, a leader that's unwilling to change. And Kevin said, I agree. You've got to work with the willing, whether it's at the bottom, at the middle, or at the top. I know my grandfather said quality starts in the boardroom. And I've heard many people say, unless you're at the top, it's not worth doing. I disagree. Because you're not always going to get the person at the top right off the bat. I believe that every single person in every single organization has some sphere of influence they can impact. And ultimately, that's what I did. When I started out working just out of college, I had leaders who were fantastic people, but they really didn't want to change because what they were doing at the time was working well. I started out as an assistant to an assistant. But I realized that I could use my grandfather's ideas and thinking to improve the areas that I had some influence over. In time, it had a real impact. And people started noticing that this guy did something really interesting and different. What it enabled me to do was to move up the organization. Eventually, those who are willing to learn the new way of thinking and applying it can end up being in charge of that leader who is unwilling to learn or to change. I mean, that he's got it. Trip, Kevin's got it. We can't wait. We can't wait for the leader to get it. We can't wait for the leader to retire. We got to find the willing, get started, and let it grow from there. And that's the purpose of the Driving Eureka book, the Driving Eureka podcast, every talk that I do, every class that we teach. It's let's find the willing and let's get started.
You know, it's interesting. As I read through here, I reflect on some of the clients that I've had in the past, and there are groups of them that did really great things with the Deming philosophy, and then there's also their reflections of failures. On my part, but there are people that you, as you're trying to change the thinking, that appear to be getting it. And then the fruits of what happens later, you start to find out that they were really kind of, I can't think of a better word for it right now, but frauds. in essence, you know, they kind of went through the motions. They say that they buy in from a change. How do you, have you run into that before? As far as people that you start to work with, you think they got it, and then they're not really committed. They're just kind of there. I don't know how else to word that.
That's right. That's right. There are people that'll do that. And you try to teach them, and if they don't get it, you move on. Yeah. That's it. Move on. I mean, I don't dwell on it. I just don't dwell on it. If you're willing to learn, I will make you amazing things. You want to have a breakthrough that transforms your industry and changes your company? No problem. Okay? No problem. I mean, I can do that. You want to learn how to become incredibly good at this? No problem. Now, if you don't want to do it, then no problem on my part either, because I'm moving on. Okay? I've been doing this 40 years, and you're not going to change people. People choose to change.
Oh, yeah.
I can't change it. And I think too many trainers think they can go in and basically do a mental lobotomy to people. It's never going to happen. Never, ever. The person changes when they're ready to change. That's it. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I think in the harder ones are when they think they've changed, and in essence, by the fruits of what they do, you can tell that they haven't. There's people that I wound up working with for years, and then found out later that they were, well, you know, I get a big bonus if I do this, but we've talked about this, you know.
Yeah.
It's the wrong thing. So anyway, okay, well, that's, yeah, that makes sense as far as being able to change in the sphere of influence that you have, or you move on. I mean, that's
right.
kind of the choices that you have associated with it. But are you true to it? Sometimes I always wonder whether I've stayed too true to it. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Okay, well, let's talk about the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Change your mind to transform your business. So how are you using change? I mean, it's pretty obvious. You guys are, in the last episode, we talked about failures, you know, and that's certainly a type of change. So one of the things that happens when you have change is you're also going to have failures associated with it, and because you're pushing the edges. So how are you using change in the Brain Brew Whiskey?
Well, this is inspired by the keynote talk at the Craft Spirits Association up in Minneapolis recently. The opening keynote was a guy who makes snowboards, and the gist of his story was he tried to sell through the normal distribution channels his innovative snowboards, and he tried that whole process, and he had massive failure. And then he changed the game. He started doing them custom. He started selling them direct. And his whole message was, you can't use the same playbook as the multinational conglomerates. You can't do it, you know. And he was trying to get these people to do it. And sadly, his message fell on totally deaf ears. You know, because so many craft spirit companies are interested, and in fact, they're embedding it in following the rules and thinking about how they make whiskey the same way it's been done for generations. You know, Johnny's, Jim's, and Jack's whiskeys, those companies have systemic advantages you can't beat. You can't compete with them. You can't play through the three-tier distribution system, through the rest of it. You can't do that. You've got to come up with how you're going to make money and what's your system for doing it, and you got to change the rules. And that means a transformation of the business and a transformation of your mindset. And it comes from, in this case here with the craft thing, there's nobody you can look to except the founder and the leader of this thing, is you've got a vision on how you're going to do something different than others. You know, in our case, mastering wood is our playbook. I mean, we are about becoming the absolute best at managing the alcohol-wood relationship. I think it's probably fair to say we know more about that relationship than everybody else in the world combined, just because we've run, you know, to close to 3,000 experiments now. We've just done more experiments than anybody else knows, and we understand a lot more of this because we can, and we are incredibly focused. And so if you like it finishing with different woods and you like to have different flavors and tastes, we can create amazing things for you. That's ours. Now, other people we work with, you know, we encourage them to do it their way. And as I've said before, you know, we had a guy just recently, he said, can I have your paddle wheel bourbon? And I go, no, that's my product. And he says, but I just want to sell it. I said, no, do something original. Create your vision. I'll work with you. I'll help you. We're called Brain Brew Custom Whiskey. We're not Brain Brew stock whiskey. We're custom whiskey. We will sell you a customized whiskey to your specifications at a fair price that you can bottle and sell in your marketplace. And that is like, bing, it blows people's brains out because they're just so used to thinking, well, if I just do something that's just like Johnny, Jim, and Jack's whiskey, I'll have something. Well, no, you're just going to have another mass market, mediocre whiskey to be. I'm not dinging them. It is what it is. They're just cheap whiskeys, all three of them in their categories.
So what was the outcome then of this, of these people? Are they going to try and craft their own?
Interestingly, there were two partners.
Okay.
There were two partners sitting at the table. Okay. And one was a chemist and the other one is a manufacturing guy. So they kind of, there wasn't even a marketing person in the room, really. One is sort of a chemist, a scientist, and one is a production person. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the chemist surprisingly was like, I totally get that. Hmm. It's like the scientist in him of discovering something new or something, got it. And he swayed the other partner.
So are they going to do it?
Yeah. Okay. They're going to do it. Yeah. I mean, he said on the way out, he says, we're going to do business. We're going to make this work. Thank you.
Interesting. Are they going to bring you in to help?
Well,
they're just going to try it on their own.
Well, they can't. I mean, the equipment's ridiculously expensive and what we've got. So, no, we're going to do it together with them. Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to partner.
Cool. So when you look at some of these other ones, you know, when you talked about Jack and, you know, Jimmy and all those guys, do you think they'll ever make the change? Do you think that they're just smug? You know, we're making money doing what we're doing, or what's your thought there?
Well, I think the same as what's happened with Budweiser and Miller and all the rest of them. You know, bourbon's hot right now, so they're doing fine. Whiskey's hot right now, so they're doing fine. And so they'll play with a few little fake, you know, craft washing things that look craft but aren't really craft. They'll play with a little bit of that stuff. But, you know, they've got a juggernaut. They've got a machine that makes a lot of money. And by the way, that's fine. That leaves the other market for crazy people like us.
Okay.
It's beer all over. Beer's going to happen all over again.
So what happens, Doug, like every other industry, unless you're Amazon, obviously, they were able to kind of keep it separate. And you're still kind of, you know, you're growing. But Jack comes along, says, okay, we'll buy you.
And some will sell. And then those products, historically, what's happened is they will then kill them.
Because they go into the system.
I mean, let's face it. Most corporate acquisitions never work out.
Yes.
So, they'll milk it for a while. Every now and then they'll get lucky. But most of them will fail because the heart and soul that made that thing what it is, the mindset that came from that, will die. Hmm. And that's the cycle of life. And then the entrepreneur will drink umbrella drinks down on the beaches. Then they'll decide they'll do it again. And then they'll sell it again.
Well, I look kind of at your history because I know I remember you telling the story of the, I think it was a kind of polling business that you had at one point and you wound up selling it. And I remember your comment in there was always sell when you're not trying to sell because that's right. when people are.
And then I went back and after a number of years, I invented an even smarter system, which is our Truth Teller system. So, you know, that's just life. I mean, in this case here, the distillery is right here. My house, we're on 80 acres here with a private lake and that just east of Cincinnati. And so the distillery is, you know, in the lot right beside my house. Mm-hmm. And everything's right here. So I put it here because I this is not for sale. Mm. I intend to do this because it's just a lot of fun to do. And it's just so many different things that we can do with it that I just really enjoy it. Now, could somebody come around and do something? Yeah, Pop, that's always possible, but it's highly unlikely in this case because this is just too much fun. I have too much to do with this. Now, 10 years from now, who knows? But right now, my intent is to do this and to help enable other craft distilleries around the world to be able to do amazing things.
Okay. But you don't see, because of the nature of, at least the way I listen to the words that you say when you talk about some of the you know, big companies, the big spirits companies, that they're not going to get this. They think they might be by trying different things, but you don't think they're going to.
Well, we've got, you know, we have a wonderful partnership with Edrington. It's a nonprofit trust to the benefit of the children of Scotland. They make the Macallan and others. And so we have a partnership with them, which is a very wonderful, wonderful partnership. And we make products for them. And that's all the big company I need.
Okay.
You know, and they're good. These guys are way better than most, because I know all the different big players.
Well, you've worked with them for a long time.
Yeah, I've over 20 years. And so they're just wonderful people. They're just great people. So we work with them. And that's enough, you know, and so then we go work with others. So, but mostly with small people. That's where it's fun, because that's where we can do crazier stuff and learn things together.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about this week's craft whiskey cocktail, which is the Italian Manhattan, which, if that name came up before, I think in one of the other drinks, but I can't remember the context now. And I think,
yeah, we've done some different Manhattans. So Manhattan is the classic hearty drink, sweet vermouth and rye. It's a drink of old men in old pubs, you know. I'm going to have a Manhattan. It's got a manliness to it, you know. And so in the idea of changing your mind, we've flipped it on its ear to make it lighter, cleaner, and fresher. And we did this by taking limoncello, which is an Italian liqueur, mm-hmm. Where you use just the peel, not the white pith, but just the peel. You soak it into a high alcohol solution, and it comes. There's no juice in it when you do it properly, and then you add some sugar to it, and it's very light and fresh. And so, mixing an ounce of limoncello with rye, deckhand rye, some ice, and stir it. And it just gives a brightness. So a way to think of this is it's a good spring Manhattan, or when we want to have some spring in the dark months to bring some lightness and brightness to our sort of more whiskey forward cocktails.
And so I'm looking at that. I guess I've not really had the limoncello, or at least I know of. I might have ordered a drink that might have had it before. Are there other drinks that contain that? I would assume so.
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of things. We've got two or three of them, actually, that we do. But this gives us it's just fun. It's a really fun, light kind of thing for you to try.
So is it for people that drink the classic Manhattan, then this would be a natural different
step?
Yeah,
I mean, what we've done is we've taken the sweet vermouth and put in a sweet lemon flavor.
Okay.
So the body of the drink is the same body that you'd have in a Manhattan. It's just, instead of the vermouth, you're getting lemon.
Okay.
And a brightness. I mean, that's the best way I can say it. It just has a brightness to it.
All right. And then the deckhand is your
five wood rye. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so that's a rye, 95% rye. Five woods in it, three oaks, maple, and cherry. And so it's just got a stupid complexity to it. And so that complexity gives a good base upon which to bring the lemon with it.
Okay. We talked a couple episodes ago about the, you know, the problem, the promise, and the proof. What is it? What is the proof of the deckhand then? What would
it's
you say?
It's five woods. It's the five woods.
It's the five wood. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And the proof is, you know, using those five different woods, which it was interesting as we were going into a competition. And and I was messing with different things, and I was with a buddy of mine, Tim Hogan, and well, the night had gone on for some time, as one would say.
Say no more.
And at one point, I said we were tasting different woods and different, you know, individual samples, and I said, I wonder what the hell happens if we mix some of these. And well, one thing led to another, and next thing you know, there were five woods added to it. I go, what do you think of that? And he's, damn, that's pretty good. And so we mixed up some others. I put it in a bottle. And I said, well, let's try it tomorrow, maybe as a first drink rather than as a last drink. And the next morning we tasted it, and we gave it to our wives. We were staying over their house, and we gave it to their wives, and they went, damn, that's pretty good. And thus was born. It's also known as the working man's rye.
Right.
As it because the deckhands, of course, were the working men on the riverboats. And so it sort of celebrates them. And it's the kind of drink that bartenders really like, because bartenders generally tend to like a rye. Rye generally will have 48% alcohol by volume, as opposed to 40% for many whiskeys or 45 for bourbons. So it's going to be a little bit higher. It's going to be a more whiskey forward thing. It's not for newbies. But it makes it really stands up to just about any cocktail you're going to do. And the five woods really just give you a complexity that it's really, really quite nice compared to some ryes can have a bit of a bite to them. And this has got a smoothness and just a stupid complexity to it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm kind of gauging my taste, and I seem to like the ryes a little bit better than the others. I'm not sure why, but it seems to kind of fit what my tastes are.
More you drink them, the more you drink them. That's not uncommon.
Okay.
So every Friday night when I get your text messages, the more you drink them, the more you're going to tend to go. But I would encourage you to also go back though, because, even just our Keelboat, our easy drinking product, mm-hmm. There are cocktails that are still better with that than they are with rye.
With rye, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It depends on the taste. It depends on what you're trying to do.
And apparently the cocktail that you have out there. So one question I have, we talk about your deckhand, your tall stacks, and your Keelboat, and the paddle wheel, and all those types of things. And you've already stated that it's pretty much local to Cincinnati. But if somebody's going through Cincinnati, is the only place to get it is at your place in Newtown, or are you starting to distribute it through local liquor stores or?
Yeah, through the spring, we'll get it into the local liquor stores.
Okay.
It'll be in the local liquor stores. And there's some conversation. We may go to a couple of other states. I haven't decided yet, but we've had some people approach us about bringing it into some other states and some other things. So it was designed totally to be a ultra local. That's one of the things I recommend to craft people is do an ultra local product. Mm-hmm. That's where you've got the leverage against other people. Yeah. And so it really is made to celebrate Cincinnati, which was, as you know, I mean, like 80% of the whiskey was coming from around this area. This was the home of American whiskey pre-prohibition, 80 distilleries in Cincinnati alone. It was not a beer town. It was a whiskey town. I mean, the value of spirits that went out was like five or seven times or something like that, the amount of beer, even though it was a German population. This is a whiskey town is what it is. And that's what we're hoping to bring back.
Very good. One last question I have for you, and I'm not sure exactly how it works, so I'm just going to ask the question for, I'm sure probably 90% of the audience probably already knows the answer. But so is whiskey, I mean, I know, you like, for instance, Indiana's a weird state, so I'm not going to use that as an example. But can you order online and get whiskey delivered? Are there rules against that? Or what's
there's a Supreme Court case that may change that. Wine got it broken. But when they overturned prohibition, they put the authority into the states. And so each state has its own rules. And so there is not... It is not, there is a few states where you can buy stuff, or there's some online people who basically, what they basically do is give you a thing and they have a local retailer in the state that mails it inside state lines, doesn't go over state lines. And there are retailers who illegally will ship to you. I'm just acknowledging it, not supporting it. But as a general rule, you cannot buy whiskey or spirits of any type and order them across state lines. There's like four states where you can do it if you register in the states, but it's really not something that's able to do. The general system that people use, and again, I'm not condoning it, I'm just reporting what I've observed, is that they'll get a friend who's near the area and they'll have them get one and send it to them. I've heard stories of people doing that, but again, that's not the way it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to do that.
What if you're driving through the city, you can pick
that's
it up?
Fine. That's fine. Okay. It's totally fine.
Okay. All right. Okay. So what's the Supreme Court case? Is it something you're following or?
Yeah. So it's a Total Wine case. Tennessee says that they can't open up a retail outlet unless they've lived there for 10 years or 15 years or something like that. And that's in front of the Supreme Court. And this has to do with what you got in the Constitution, and I'm not an expert at this, but there's a contradiction in the Constitution between the Commerce Clause that says there's going to be free trade across states and alcohol, which the states can regulate. And so the question is, you know, basically the amendment to the Constitution contradicts the Commerce Clause. And so, you know, eventually this has got to get resolved. And they did resolve it for wine, but they only mentioned wine. They didn't mention spirits, which is why you can oftentimes buy wine across. But even then, some states say you can't. And then eventually they get challenged in court and it gets overturned sometimes. So long term, this is going to get resolved. It's just a matter of time. Same in Canada. Canada had a case. They thought it was going to do it. Their Supreme Court punted on the issue. Eventually, there will be an opening of this stuff, you know, across, and a mechanism, because right now the states make a lot of money on booze. And I think primarily the biggest thing is going to be is making it possible for the states to collect their money when it's shipped in. And, you know, I would be surprised if 5 years or definitely 10 years from now, if this is still the case. I think it's going to happen quite broadly. You're going to be able to get it. In most other countries, you can ship. We just happen to have a backwards system. You know, it was done to protect people, the three-tier system and all these things. It was done to protect people from stuff. And there's people that lobby a lot, but the pressures on this are severe. And you know, the question is it in the public interest, honestly? And the reality is, no, it's not.
So would you find, for instance, as the growth of these craft whiskey companies come around, I would think there'd be even more pressure to open it up, and that the big ones would probably say no. Is that kind of where the battle lines would be drawn?
Some, but it's mostly the distributors. It's mostly the distributors that will fight that. The three-tier system, they're the ones that are going to do it more so than the manufacturers.
Okay.
It's really the distributors who, you know, right now have a hammer lock on it, so that you got to go through them. So I understand it. I mean, it is what it is. They built a business on it, and they risked money and stuff at the beginning. I respect all of that stuff, but at the same time, I'm for free trade, whether it be from here to Indiana or here to London.
Well, Indiana just got Sunday liquor sales a year ago, so don't plan on a big change in Indiana. We aren't going to be leading that charge.
a little bit slow.
just a tad. So yeah, it was a big celebration to get Sunday liquor sales in Indiana, which was, it's so bizarre. But anyway, okay, all right. Well, interesting. Change in the whiskey business.
That's right. Change the mindset. Change the mindset. Play by your rules, not others.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. the Driving Eureka Prescription for Success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. To the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.